that did the damage. I see, meaning, oh dear, another point to us. Chip, chip, chip. Sparks parried the blows patiently. He'd faced a number of Sandersons over the years, old boy show-offs, and knew this sort of grandstanding didn't always play well with a jury. They reached the sweet paper discovery, and Sanderson took the expected line about the chances of contamination of evidence. Detective Inspector, how long was the sweet paper in Jean Taylor's coat pocket? Sparks kept his voice steady, making sure he looked across at the jurors to emphasize the point. 8 months, we believe. She said in her statement that she found it in the van on December the 17th. It was the only time she was allowed to go on a delivery with her husband, so she remembers it well. 8 months? That's a long time to gather other fluff and hair, isn't it? Hair from a grey Burmese cross, like the Elliot family cat? We will bring expert testimony to say that is statistically extremely unlikely. And the likelihood of a coincidence drops still further when that cat hair evidence is found on a Skittles packet. Both a Burmese crosscat and a Skittle were present at the scene when Bella Elliot was abducted. Sparks saw that the jurors were writing notes, and Sanderson moved swiftly on. Sparks took a gulp of water from the glass at his elbow. He knew his adversary was building up to his big moment, the Goldilocks conversations. Sparks had prepared with the lawyers to make sure he was ready. He knew every nuance of the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act 2000, every step of the authorization procedure, the careful preparation of the CHIS, and the preservation and chain of evidence. The team had spent a significant amount of time prepping him to emphasize Taylor's use of chat rooms and his porn habit. The jury won't be interested in subclause 101 or who gave permission for what. We need to tell them about the risk of Taylor feeding his appetite for baby girls, the CPS team leader had urged, and Sparks knew he was right. He felt ready when the barrister marched into the minefield of pornography addiction, challenging the police action every step of the way. Sanderson's goal was to force him to concede that Taylor could have inadvertently downloaded some of the more extreme images found on his computer. The images of children being sexually abused? Sparks had answered. We believe he deliberately downloaded them, that he couldn't have done it accidentally, and experts will testify on that matter. We also have experts who will say that it could have been accidental, Inspector. Sparks knew the defense was helped by the fact that Taylor looked nothing like the perverts who normally appeared in court. The prosecution team told him that Sanderson had shown a photo of his client to the juniors and solicitors in his chambers, and the words most often used to describe him in his impromptu focus groups were clean-cut. With the images filed away, Sanderson challenged the detective head-on about Bella Elliott's disappearance. Detective Inspector Sparks, isn't it right that Bella Elliott has never been found? Yes, that is correct. And that your team has failed to find any leads to her whereabouts? No, that isn't right. Our investigation led us to the accused. Your case is based on suspicions, supposition, and circumstantial evidence, not facts, Inspector, isn't it? We've clear evidence to link the accused to the disappearance of Bella Elliott. Ah, the evidence. Forensic guesswork and unreliable witnesses. All a bit flimsy because, I suggest, you were always after the wrong man. You were so desperate you resorted to leading my client into a fictitious and mendacious relationship. The jurors didn't look like they knew what a fictitious and mendacious relationship was, but they looked interested in the spectacle. 4 stars and compelling performances was how the Telegraph might review it the next day, Sparks thought, as he finally stepped down from the witness box at lunchtime and returned to his seat in the audience. But the star turn came that afternoon. Dulled by an institutional lunch, the jurors filed back in and slumped in their seats. They did not stay there long. The mother entered the witness box, dressed in simple black with a red Find Bella badge blooming on her breast. Spark smiled encouragingly at her, but he was unhappy she'd chosen to wear the badge and concerned about the questions it would raise. The prosecutor, a reed of a woman alongside the bulk of her opponent, led Dawn Elliott through her evidence in chief, letting the young woman tell her story simply and effectively. When Dawn broke down, as she described the moment when she realized her child had gone, the jurors were transfixed, and some seemed close to tears themselves. The judge asked her if she'd like a glass of water, and the usher obliged as the barristers rustled their papers, ready to resume. It was Sanderson's turn. "Miss Elliott, did Bella often go outside to play? Out at the front where you couldn't see her?"
"Sometimes, but only for a few minutes."
"Minutes pass very quickly, don't you find? So many things to do as a mum." The mother smiled at this bit of sympathy.
"It can get busy, but I know she was only out of my sight for minutes."
"How do you know?"
"I was just cooking some pasta, like I said before. That doesn't take long."
"Anything else?"
"Well, I did the washing up as I went along, and I folded some of Bella's clothes from the tumble dryer so I wouldn't have to iron them."
"Sounds like a busy afternoon for you. And there were a couple of calls to your mobile as well. Easy to forget that Bella was outside."
Dawn began sobbing again, but Sanderson did not falter.
"I know this is hard for you, Miss Elliott, but I just want to establish the time frame when Bella disappeared. You understand how important this is, don't you?"
She nodded and blew her nose.
"And we're relying on you to pinpoint this, because the last time anyone else saw Bella was at the newspaper shop at 11:35. Wasn't it, Miss Elliott?"
"We bought some sweets."
"Yes, Smarties, according to the till receipt. But that means the window for Bella's disappearance is actually from 11:35 to 3:30. That's almost 4 hours, because no one else laid eyes on her during that time."
Voice dropping, Dawn gripped the rail of the witness box.
"No, we didn't go out again. But my mum heard Bella when she rang in the afternoon. She told me to give her a kiss."
"Miss Elliott, please could you keep your voice up so the learned judge and jury can hear your evidence?"
Dawn cleared her throat and mouthed sorry to the judge.
"Your mother heard a child's voice in the background, but that could have been on the television, Miss Elliott, couldn't it? Your mother told the police she didn't speak to Bella, didn't she?"
"Bella wouldn't come to the phone. She ran off to get something."
"I see.
And then she went outside a couple hours later." "She was only out of my sight for a few minutes."
"Yes, thank you, Miss Elliott."
Dawn made to step down from the box, but Sanderson halted her.
"Not quite finished, Miss Elliott. I see you were wearing a Find Bella badge."
Dawn touched the badge instinctively.
"You believe that Bella is still alive, don't you?"
the barrister asked. Dawn Elliott nodded, uncertain where the question was going.
"Indeed, you have sold interviews to newspapers and magazines saying exactly that."
The accusation that she was making money out of her missing child made the press benches vibrate, and pens pause for the response. Dawn was defensive, and suddenly loud.
"Yes, I do hope she's alive. But she's been taken, and that man took her.
She pointed at Taylor, who looked down and began writing on his legal pad.
And the money is for the Fine Bella Fund, she added quietly.
I see, the barrister said, and sat down. He had to wait through another week of neighbours, police experts, sick jurors, and legal argument before D.C. Dan Fry entered the witness box to give his evidence. It was Fry's big moment, and he stood with trembling legs, despite the frequent rehearsals with his bosses. The prosecutor painted the picture of a young, dedicated officer, backed by his superiors and the legal process, and determined to prevent another child from being taken. She lingered over the words used by Glenn Taylor, glancing over to the jurors to underline the importance of the evidence, and they began to glance over at the accused. It was going well. When Sanderson rose to take his turn, there were no hands in pockets, no lazy vowels. This was his moment. The young officer was taken through the conversations he'd had as Goldilocks, line by ghastly line. He'd been prepared by the prosecution for the pressure he'd be put under, but it was much worse than anyone could have foreseen. He was asked to read out his replies to Big Bear's obscene banter, and in the cold light of the courtroom, they took on a surreal, sniggerish air. "What are you wearing tonight?" The barrister, his face drink-mottled and his shoulders dusted with dandruff, asked. Straight-faced, 6'3", Fry red. Baby doll pajamas, my blue ones with the lace. There was a suppressed bark of laughter from the press box, but Fry kept his nerve and read on. I'm a bit hot. I might have to take them off.
Yes, take them off. The barrister intoned in a bored voice. Then touch yourself.
It's all a bit adolescent, isn't it? He added. I assume you were not wearing blue baby doll pajamas, Detective Constable Fry.
The laughter from the public gallery bruised him, but Fry took a deep breath and said, No. Order was quickly restored, but the damage was done. Fry's crucial evidence was in danger of being reduced to a dirty joke. The barrister basked in the moment before entering the most dangerous area of the cross-examination, the last email conversation with Glenn Taylor. He addressed it head-on.
Detective Constable Fry, did Glenn Taylor, a.k.a. Big Bear, say he'd kidnapped Bella Elliott?
He said he'd had a real baby girl before.
That's not what I asked you. And was this after you, as Goldilocks, asked him to tell you that?
No, sir.
He asked you, would you like that Goldie? And you told him you'd like that very much. You said it was a turn-on.
He could have said no at any stage, Fry said, but he didn't.
He said he'd found a baby girl once, and her name began with B. Did he use the name Bella ever in your conversations?
No.
This was a fantasy conversation between two consenting adults, D.C. Fry. This was not a confession.
He said he'd found a baby girl. Her name began with B, Fry insisted, the emotion beginning to break through.
How many baby girls with names beginning with B have been taken recently?
The barrister ignored the question and scanned his notes. Bob Sparks looked at Jean Taylor perched on the edge of a bench, below her fantasizing, consenting adult husband, and saw the numbness.
It must be the first time she's heard the whole story, he thought.
He wondered who felt worse. Him with the case falling apart in front of him, or her with the case piling up in front of her. Fry was beginning to stutter now, and Sparks silently willed him to pull himself together. But Sanderson continued his attack.
You coerced Glenn Taylor into making these remarks, didn't you, Constable Fry? You acted as an agent provocateur by pretending to be a woman who wanted to have sex with him. You were determined to get him to make damning statements. You would do anything, even have internet sex with him. Is this really police work? Where was the caution or the right to a lawyer?
Sanderson, who was well into his stride, looked almost regretful when his victim finally stepped down from the witness box, diminished and exhausted. The defense immediately called for an adjournment and, with the jurors safely tucked away in the jury room, made the case that the trial should be halted.
This whole case rests on circumstantial evidence and an entrapment. It cannot continue, Sanderson said. The Goldilocks evidence must be ruled as inadmissible.
The judge tapped her pencil impatiently as she listened to the prosecution's response.
The police acted entirely properly in every respect. They followed procedures to the letter. They believed they had proper cause, that this was the only way to get the final piece of evidence, the prosecutor said, and sat down.
The judge put down her pencil and looked at her notes in silence.
I will retire, she said finally, and the court rose as she walked back to her chambers.
20 minutes later, the clerk called, All rise, and the judge delivered her decision. She ruled the Goldilocks evidence out, criticizing Fry's encouragement and prompting and the exposure of such a junior officer.
The evidence is unsafe and cannot be relied upon, she said.
Sparks knew it was simply a formality for the prosecution team to throw in the towel and offer no further evidence, and began packing his briefcase. In the dock, Taylor listened to the judge carefully, the reality slowly dawning on him that he was about to be freed. Below him, Jean Taylor looked stunned.
I wonder what she's thinking, Sparks muttered to Matthews. She's got to go home with a porn addict who has cyber sex with strangers dressed as children, and a child killer.
Suddenly, it was over. The judge ordered the jury to return formal verdicts of not guilty, and Taylor was taken down to the cells to prepare for freedom. In the courtroom, a press free-for-all began with Jean Taylor as the main prize. She half stood, surrounded by reporters, white-faced and silent, as Tom Paine tried to extricate her from the pew in the well of the court. Finally, the press parted, and she struggled sideways like a fleeing crab, her legs knocking against the bench in front, and her bag strap catching on edges.
Chapter 27. The Widow. Monday, February 11th, 2008. She gives evidence, of course. Her big moment. She wears a black dress and a Find Bella badge. I try to avoid her stare, but she's determined. And in the end, our eyes meet. I feel hot, and the flush rises up my face, so I look away. It doesn't happen again. She keeps staring at Glenn, but he's wise to her game and looks straight ahead. I find my attention wandering as she tells the story I've read and heard 100 times since she lost her baby. A nap, then playtime while she cooks tea. Bella laughing as she chases Timmy the cat out the front door and into the garden, then realizing she can't hear her anymore. The silence. The court goes completely quiet too. We can all hear that silence. The moment when Bella vanished. Then she sobs and has to sit down with a glass of water. Very effective. The jury looks worried, and one or two of the older women look like they might cry as well. It's all going wrong. They must see this is all her fault. That's what Glenn and I think. She let her baby out of her sight. She didn't care enough. Glenn sits quietly and lets it all wash over him, like it's happening to someone else. When the mum is ready, the judge lets her stay sitting down to finish her evidence. and Glenn cocks his head to listen to her story of running to neighbours, ringing the police, and waiting for news as the hunt went on. The prosecutor uses this special tone of voice with her, treating her like she's made of glass. "Thank you very much, Miss Elliot. You've been very brave. I want to shout, you've been a very bad mother. But I know I can't, not here." Our barrister, a scary old bloke, who had shaken my hand firmly at each meeting, but gave no other sign that he knew who I was, finally gets his turn. The mother begins sobbing when the questions get hard, but our barrister doesn't put on the understanding voice. Dawn Elliot keeps saying her little girl was out of her sight for only a few minutes, but we all know now that she wasn't. The jury is beginning to look at her a bit harder now, about time. "You believe that Bella is still alive, don't you?" the barrister asks. There is a rustle in the court, and the mum starts sniffling again. He points out that she's been selling her story to the press, and she looks really angry and says the money is for her campaign. One of the reporters gets up and goes out quickly, clutching his notebook. "He's going to file that line to his news desk," Tom whispers, and winks. "It's a goal for us," he means. When it's all over, when the police have been told off for tricking Glenn and he's been freed, I feel completely numb. My turn to feel like this is happening to someone else. Tom Payne finally lets go of my arm when we get into one of the witness rooms and we stand, catching our breath. Neither of us speaks for a moment. "Can he come home now?" I ask him, my voice sounding strange and flat after all that noise in the courtroom. Tom nods and busies himself with his briefcase. Then he takes me downstairs to the cells to see Glenn. My Glenn. "I always said the truth would come out," he says triumphantly when he spots me. "We've done it, Jean. We've bloody well done it." I hug him when I get to him. It's been a long time since I've held him, and it means I don't have to say anything, because I don't know what to say to him. He's so happy, like a little boy, pink and laughing, a bit out of control. All I keep thinking is that I've got to go home with him, be on my own with him. What will it be like when we shut the door? I know too much about this other man I'm married to for it to be like before. He tries to pick me up and whirl me round like he used to when we were younger, but there are too many people in the room. The lawyers, the barristers, the prison officers. They're all around me and I can't breathe. Tom notices and takes me out into a cool hall and sits me down with a glass of water. "It's a lot to take in, Jean," he says kindly. "All a bit sudden. But it's what we all hoped would happen, isn't it? You've waited a long time for this moment." I raise my head, but he doesn't look me in the eye. We don't speak again. I keep thinking about that poor young officer, pretending to be a woman to try to get to the truth. I'd thought he'd acted like a prostitute when Tom told us about the evidence. But when I watched him in the witness box, with everyone laughing at his act, I felt sorry for him. He would have done anything to find Bella. When Glenn comes out, Tom goes to him and shakes his hand again. Then we leave. On the pavement, Dawn Elliot is weeping for the cameras. "She'll have to be careful what she says," Tom says, as we hover by the doors at the back of the mob. She's bathed in light from the TV cameras, and the reporters are tripping over power cables, trying to get near her. She's saying she'll never give up looking for her little girl, that she's out there somewhere, and she'll find out the truth about what happened to her. When she finishes, she's led away by friends to a waiting car and is gone. Then it's our turn. Glenn's decided to let Tom read his statement. Well, Tom advised it. He wrote it. We step into the spotlight, and there's a noise that physically shakes me. The noise of 100 voices shouting at once, firing questions without waiting for answers, demanding attention. "Over here, Jean," a voice near me hollers. I turn to find out who it is, and the flash goes off in my face. "Give him a hug," another says. I recognize some of them from the pavement in front of the house. I go to smile, then realize they're not friends. They're something else. They're the press. Tom is all serious and quiets everything down. I'm going to read Mr. Taylor's statement. He's not going to be answering any questions. A forest of tape recorders rises above heads. I am an innocent man who has been hounded by police and deprived of my liberty for a crime I never committed. I'm very grateful to the court for their decision, but today I'm not celebrating my acquittal. Bella Elliott is still missing, and the person who took her is still out there. I hope the police will now get back to finding the guilty person. I would like to thank my family for standing by me, and I would like to pay a special tribute to my wonderful wife, Jeannie. Thank you for listening. I would ask you to respect our privacy now as we try to rebuild our lives. I look at my shoes throughout, filling in the gaps in my head. Wonderful wife. This is my role now. The wonderful wife who stood by her husband. There's a single silent beat, and then the noise is deafening again. Who do you think took Bella? What do you think of the police tactics, Glenn? Then a passerby shouts, "Well done, mate," and Glenn grins in response. It is the picture everyone uses the next day. An arm snakes through the cameramen and hands me a card. It has congratulations on it and a picture of a bottle of champagne with a cork popping. I try to see who the arm belongs to, but it's been swallowed up. So I slide the card in my bag and am guided forward with Glenn and Tom and some of the security people. The press comes too. It's like a swarm of bees moving in a cartoon. That journey home is a taste of what is to come. The reporters and photographers block the way to the taxi Tom has got waiting for us, and we can't move forward. People are pushing one another, and us, shouting their stupid questions into our faces, shoving their cameras everywhere. Glenn has my hand, and he suddenly makes a break for it, dragging me behind him. Tom has the door of the taxi open, and we throw ourselves into the back seat. Cameras are slammed against the windows, flashing and banging metal on glass, and we just sit there, like fish in an aquarium. The driver is sweating, but you can see he's enjoying it. "Bloody hell," he says. "What a circus!" The journalists are still shouting. "What's it feel like to be a free man, Glenn? What do you want to say to Bella's mother? Do you blame the police?" Of course he does blame them. He stews over it, the humiliation, and the baby doll pajamas. Funny how he can think about that, when he's been accused of killing a little girl. But getting even with the police becomes his new addiction. Chapter 28. The Widow. Wednesday, April 2nd, 2008. I've always wondered what it would feel like if I let out the secret. Sometimes I daydream about it and can hear myself saying, "My husband saw Bella the day she was taken," and I feel the physical release like a rush to the head. But I can't, can I? I'm as guilty as he is. It's a strange feeling owning a secret. It's like a stone in my stomach, crushing my insides and making me feel sick every time I think of it. My friend Lisa used to talk about being pregnant like that, the baby pushing everything out of its way, overwhelming her body. My secret does that. When it gets to be too much, I switch to being Jeannie for a while and pretend the secret belongs to someone else. But that didn't help when Bob Sparks was questioning me the first time after Glenn's arrest. I felt heat rising through my body, my face red and my scalp pinpricked with sweat. Bob Sparks was trespassing in my lie. "So what did you say you did on the day Bella disappeared?" My breathing became shallow, and I tried to catch and control it. But my voice betrayed me. It became a breathless squeak, a deafening dry gulp as I swallowed mid-sentence. "I'm lying," my treacherous body said. "Oh, in the morning, work, you know. I had a couple of highlights to do," I say, hoping the truths in my lie will convince. I was at work, after all. Justify, justify, deny, deny. It ought to get easier, but it doesn't. As each lie feels sourer and tighter, like an unripe apple, unyielding and mouth-drying. The simple lies are the hardest, funnily enough. The big ones seem to just fall off the tongue. Glenn? Oh, he left the bank because he has other ambitions. He wants to start his own transport company. Wants to be his own boss. Easy. But the little ones? I can't come out for coffee because I've got to go to my mum's. Stick and stutter, making me flush. Lisa didn't seem to notice in the beginning. Or if she did, she hid it well. We're all living in my lie now. I was never a liar as a child. My mum and dad would have been able to tell immediately, and I didn't have a brother or sister to share a secret with. With Glenn, it turned out it was easy. We were a team, he'd say, after the police came around. Funny that. I hadn't thought of us as a team for a long time before that. We each had our departments. But Bella's disappearance brought us together, made us a real couple. I always said we needed a child. Ironic, really. You see, I was going to leave him. After he was released by the court. After I knew all about his online stuff. His sexcursions, as he called them in the chat rooms. The stuff that he was going to put behind him. You see, Glenn likes to put things behind him. When he says it, it means we'll never talk about it again. He can do that. Just cut off a part of his life and let it drift away. We need to be thinking of the future, Jeannie, not the past, he'd explained patiently, drawing me closer, kissing my head. It made sense when he said it like that, and I learned never to go back to the things we'd put behind us. It didn't mean I didn't think about them, but it was understood that I wouldn't mention them again to him. Not being able to have a baby was one of those things, and losing his job, and then the chat rooms, and all the awful things with the police. "Let's put it behind us, love," he said the day after the court case ended. We were lying in bed. It was so early, the street lights were still on, shining through a gap in the curtains. Neither of us had slept much. "Too much excitement," Glenn said. He'd made some plans, he said. He'd decided to get back to a normal life, to our life, as quickly as possible, to make things like they were before. It sounded so simple when he said it, and I tried to put all the things I'd heard out of my mind. But they wouldn't go. They kept hiding in corners and leering at me. I stewed for a few weeks before I made a decision. In the end, it was the pictures of children that made me pack a bag. I'd stood by him from the day he was accused of Bella's murder, because I believed in him. I knew my Glenn couldn't do something so awful. But that was over now, thank God. He'd been found not guilty. Now I had to look at the other stuff that he did do. He denied it all when I said I couldn't live with a man who looked at pictures like that. It's not real, Jeannie. Our experts said in court that they're not really kids in those pictures. They're women who look really young and dress up as kids for a living. Some of them are really in their 30s. But they look like children, I shouted. They do it for people who want to see children and men doing those things. He started to cry. You can't leave me, Jeannie, he said. I need you. I shook my head and went and got my bag. I was shaking because I'd never seen Glenn like this before. He was the one who was always in control, the strong one. And when I came downstairs, he was waiting to trap me with his confession. You see, he told me he'd done something for me. He said he loved me. He knew I wanted a child so badly it was killing me, and that was killing him. And when he saw her, he knew he could make me happy. It was for me. He said it was like a dream. He stopped to eat his lunch and look at his paper, in a side street, and saw her at a garden gate, looking at him. She was alone. He couldn't help himself. When he told me, he put his arms around me, and I couldn't move. I wanted to bring her home for you. She was standing there, and I smiled at her, and she put her arms up to me. She wanted me to pick her up. I got out of the van, but I don't remember anything else. Next thing, I was driving the van home to you. I didn't hurt her, Jeannie, he said. It was like a dream. Do you think it was a dream, Jeannie? His story is so shocking, I'm choking on its details. We're standing in our hallway, and I can see our reflection in the mirror. It's like seeing it happening in a film. Glenn is bending down so our heads touch, sobbing on my shoulder, with me, deathly pale. I'm patting his hair and shushing him. But I don't want him to stop crying. I'm afraid of the silence that will follow. There is so much I want to ask, but so much I don't want to know. Glenn stops after a while, and we sit on the sofa together. Shouldn't we tell the police? Tell them you saw her that day, I ask. I have to say it out loud, or my head will burst. He stiffens beside me. They'll say I took her and killed her, Jeannie, and you know I didn't. Even seeing her will make me the guilty man, the man they put in prison. We can't say anything to anyone. I sit, unable to speak. He's right, though. Seeing Bella would be as good as taking her, as far as Bob Sparks is concerned. I just keep thinking, Glenn can't have taken her. He just saw her, that's it. He just saw her. He didn't do anything wrong. He's still gulping from the sobs, and his face is red and wet. I keep thinking maybe I did dream it. It didn't feel real. And you know I wouldn't hurt a child, he says. And I nod. I think I know, but really, I don't know anything about this man that I've lived with all these years. He's a stranger, but we're bound together tighter than we've ever been. He knows me. He knows my weakness. He knows that I would have wanted him to take her and bring her home. I know that I caused all this trouble with my obsession. Afterward, when I'm in the kitchen making him a cup of tea, I realize he didn't use Bella's name. Like, she isn't real to him. I take my bag back upstairs and unpack my things while Glenn lies on the sofa, watching football on the telly. Like normal. Like nothing has happened. We don't talk about Bella again. Glenn is very nice to me, telling me he loves me all the time. Checking up to make sure I'm all right. Checking on me. What are you up to, Jeannie? He says when he rings my mobile. And so we carry on. But Bella is with us all the time. We don't talk about her, don't mention her name. We carry on as my secret starts to grow inside me, kicking at my heart and stomach, making me throw up in the downstairs toilet when I wake up and remember. He was drawn to Bella because of me. He wanted to find a baby for me. And I wonder what I would have done if he had brought her home to me. I would have loved her. That's what I would have done. Just loved her. She would have been mine to love. She was almost mine. Glenn and I still shared a bed afterward. My mum couldn't believe it. How can you bear to have him near you, Jean, after all the things he did with those women and that man? Mum and I never talked about sex, normally. It was my best friend at school who told me how babies were made and about periods. Mum wasn't very easy talking about things like that. It was like it was dirty somehow. I suppose Glenn's sex life, being in the papers, made it easier for her to say it out loud. After all, everyone else in the country knew about it. It was like talking about someone she didn't really know. It wasn't real, Mum. It was all make-believe, I told her, not catching her eye. It's something all men do in their heads, the psychologist said. Your father doesn't, she said. Anyway, we've decided to put it all behind us and look to the future, Mum. She looked at me like she was going to say something important, but then stopped. It's your life, Jean. You must do what you think best. Our life, Mum. Mine and Glenn's. Glenn said I should start looking for a little job, outside the area. I told him I was nervous about facing strangers, but we agreed I needed something to keep me busy and out of the house. Glenn said he'd go back to the idea of starting his own business, but not driving this time. Something on the internet, some kind of service. Everyone's doing it, Jeannie. Easy money, and I've got the skills. I wanted to say so many things, but it seemed best to keep quiet. Our attempt at looking to the future lasted about 2 months. I'd begun working Fridays and Saturdays at a big salon in town, big enough to be anonymous with lots of walk-ins and not too many prying questions. Classier than Hair Today, and the hair products were very expensive. You could tell they cost a fortune because they smelled of almonds. On my work days, I caught the tube up to Bond Street and walked the rest. It felt okay. Better than I thought. Glenn stayed at home in front of his screen, building his empire, as he called it. He was buying and selling stuff on eBay, car stuff. There were always parcels being delivered and clogging up the hall, but it kept him busy. I helped a bit, wrapping things up and going to the post office for him. We got into a routine. But neither of us could put the case behind us. I couldn't stop thinking about Bella, my almost little girl. I found myself thinking it should have been us. She should have been here with us, our baby. Sometimes I found myself wishing he had picked her up that day. But Glenn wasn't thinking about Bella. He couldn't put the entrapment behind him. It weighed on his mind. I could see him brooding, working himself up. And every time there was something on the telly about the police, he'd sit there fuming, saying how they'd ruined his life. I tried to persuade him to let it go, to look to the future. But he didn't seem to hear me. He must have made a phone call because Tom Payne came to see us one Thursday morning to explain about suing the Hampshire Police Force. We'd get compensation for what they put Glenn through, he said. So we should. I was locked up for months because of their tricks, Glenn said, and I went to make some tea. When I came back, they were working out figures on Tom's big yellow pad. He was always good at numbers, Glenn. So clever. When they did the last calculation, Tom said, I reckon you should get about a quarter of a million. And Glenn whooped like we'd won the lottery. I wanted to say that we didn't need the money, that I didn't want this dirty money. But I just smiled and went over and held Glenn's hand. It was a long process, but it gave Glenn a new focus. The eBay parcels stopped arriving, and instead he sat at the kitchen table with his paperwork, reading reports and crossing stuff out, highlighting other bits with new coloured pens, punching holes in documents and filing them in his different folders. Sometimes he read a bit out to me to see what I thought. The effect of the case and the stigma attached to it mean that Mr. Taylor now suffers frequent panic attacks when he leaves the house. Do you? I asked. I hadn't noticed. Not like my mum's panic attacks anyway. Well, I feel churned up inside, he said. Do you think they'll want a doctor's note? We didn't go out much anyway, just to the shops and once to the pictures. We tended to go very early and shop in big anonymous supermarkets where you don't have to talk to anyone. But he was nearly always recognised. Not surprising, really. His picture was in the papers every day when the trial was on, and the girls on the tills knew it was him. I said I'd go on my own, but he wouldn't hear of it. He wouldn't let me face it alone. He held my hand and braved it out. And I learned to give anyone who dared say a word a look, to shut them up. It was more difficult when I met people I knew. When they saw me, some crossed the road, pretended they hadn't noticed me. Others wanted to know everything. I found myself saying the same thing over and over. We're fine. We knew the truth would come out, that Glenn is innocent. The police have got a lot to answer for. Mostly people seemed glad for us, but not all. One of my old clients from the salon said, but none of us are completely innocent, are we? I told her it had been lovely to see her, but I had to get back to help Glenn. It'll mean going back to court, I worked myself up to say to him one day. Having everything dug up again and gone through. I'm not sure. Glenn stood and held me. I know it's hard for you, love, but this will be my vindication. This will make sure people know what I went through, what we went through. I could see the sense in that, and tried to be more helpful, remembering dates and terrible encounters with people in public to put in his evidence. Remember that bloke at the cinema? He said he wouldn't sit in the same room with a paedophile, shouted it and pointed at you. Of course Glenn remembered. We'd had to be escorted out of Screen 2 by security, for our own safety, the manager said. The bloke kept shouting, "What about Bella?" And the woman with him was trying to make him sit down. I'd wanted to say something, that my husband was innocent, but Glenn gripped my arm and said, "Don't, Jean. It'll make it worse. He's just some nutter." He didn't like remembering this, but he wrote it down in his statement. "Thanks, love," he said. The police resisted the compensation claim. Tom said they have to, because it's taxpayers' money they have to pay out. Until the very last minute. I was getting dressed in my court outfit when Glenn, already in his good suit and shoes, got a call from Tom. "It's over, Jeannie," he shouted up the stairs. "They've paid up. $250,000. The papers and Dawn Elliott called it blood money, made on the back of her little girl. The reporters wrote horrible things about him again, and they were back outside. I wanted to say, "I told you so," but what good would that do? Glenn went quiet again, and I packed in the job before they could let me go. Back to where we started.
Chapter 29. The Detective. Monday, July 21st, 2008. After the trial collapsed, there was a different kind of sadness for Bob Sparks, and anger. Most directed at himself. He'd allowed himself to be seduced into this disastrous strategy. What had he been thinking? He'd heard one of the senior officers describe him as a glory hunter as he passed an open door on the top floor, and he'd cringed inside. He thought he'd been thinking of Bella, but perhaps it was all about him. "Anyway, it's not glory I'm covered in," he told himself. The report that finally emerged, 5 months after the end of the trial, was written in the sanitized language of such documents, concluding that the decision to use an undercover officer to obtain evidence against the suspect was taken on the basis of expert opinion and extensive consultation with senior officers, but the strategy was ultimately flawed due to the lack of proper supervision of an inexperienced officer. "We screwed up," was the bottom line, Sparks told Eileen on the phone after a terse meeting with his chief constable. The next day, he was named and shamed, along with his bosses in the papers, as one of the top cops who had wrecked the Bella case. There were calls for heads to roll from politicians and columnists, and Sparks kept his head down as the clichés were trotted out and tried to prepare himself for life after being a copper. Eileen seemed almost pleased at the thought of him leaving the force, suggesting security work, something corporate. "She means something clean," he thought. His kids were brilliant, ringing most days to urge him on and make him smile with bits of their news. But he couldn't look much beyond the end of each day. He started running again, remembering the release it had given him as a young father, letting the rhythm of his pounding feet fill his mind for at least an hour. But he returned home grey-faced and sweating, his 50-year-old knees killing him. Eileen said he had to stop. It was making him ill, that and everything else. In the end, his disciplinary hearing was a civilized affair, with questions posed politely but firmly. They already knew all the answers, but procedures had to be followed. He was put on paid leave while he waited for the outcome and took the call, still in his pajamas, from his union representative. The force had decided to place the blame higher up, and he would have a reprimand on his record, but he wouldn't be sacked. He didn't know whether to laugh or cry. Eileen cried and hugged him hard.
"Oh, Bob, it's all over," she said. "Thank God they saw sense."
The next day he went back to work, assigned to different duties.
"A fresh start for us all," DCI Chloe Wellington, newly promoted to fill the disgraced Breakspear's chair, told him as part of some sort of re-education interview.
"I know it is tempting, but leave Glenn Taylor to someone else. You can't go back to it, not after all this publicity. It would look like victimization, and any new lines would be tainted by that."
And Sparks nodded, talking convincingly about the new cases on his desk, budgets, rosters, and a bit of office gossip. But as he walked back to his office, Glenn Taylor was top of his list. He was the only name on his list. Matthews was waiting for him, and they closed the door to talk tactics.
"They'll be watching us, boss, to make sure we don't go anywhere near him. They've brought in a senior detective from Basingstoke to review and plan next steps for the Bella Elliott case. A woman, but a good bloke. Jude Downing. Do you know her?"
D.I. Jude Downing tapped on Sparks's door that afternoon and suggested a coffee. Slim and red-haired, she sat opposite him in a cafe down the road.
"Cafeteria's a bit of a bear pit," she said. "Let's get a latte."
And waited.
"He's still out there, Jude," Sparks said finally.
"What about Bella?"
"I don't know, Jude. I'm haunted by her."
"Does that mean she's dead?" she asked, and he didn't know how to answer.
When he was thinking like a copper, he knew she was dead. But he could not let her go. Dawn was still interviewed on slow news days, her childlike face staring accusingly out of the pages. He had continued to ring her every week or so.
"No news, Dawn. Just checking in," he would say. "How are things?"
And she would tell him. She had met a man she liked through the Find Bella campaign and was managing to get through the days.
"There are three of us in this marriage,"
Eileen said once, and laughed that dry, fake laugh she reserved for punishing him. He hadn't risen to it, but he stopped mentioning the case at home and promised to finish painting their bedroom. Jude Downing told him she was looking at every piece of evidence to see if anything had been missed.
"We've all been there, Bob. You can get so close to a case like this, you can't see clearly anymore. It's not a criticism, just how it is."
Sparks stared into the froth on his coffee. They had dusted a chocolate heart on it.
"You're right, Jude. Fresh eyes needed. But I can help you."
"Best if you step back for the moment, Bob. No offence, but we need to start from the beginning again and follow our own leads."
"Okay. Thanks for the coffee. Better get back."
Eileen listened patiently later as she poured him a beer, and he vented his rage.
"Let her get on with it, love. You are giving yourself an ulcer. Do the breathing exercises the doctor gave you."
He sipped and practiced the feeling of letting things go, but it just felt like letting things slip away from him. He tried to immerse himself in his new cases, but it was surface activity. A month later, Ian Matthews announced a move to another force.
"Needed a change, Bob," he said. "We all do."
Ian Matthews's farewell was a classic. Speeches from the grown-ups, then a drink-fueled orgy of hideous anecdotes and maudlin reminiscences about crime solved.
"End of an era, Ian,"
he told him as he released himself from his sergeant's beery hug.
"You've been brilliant."
He was the last man standing, he told himself, apart from Glenn Taylor. His new sergeant arrived, a frighteningly clever 35-year-old girl.
Woman, Bob, Eileen had corrected him. Girls have pigtails.
She didn't have pigtails. She wore her glossy brown hair up in a tight bun, the tension on the fine hairs at her temples causing her skin to pucker. She was a sturdy young woman with a degree and a career path apparently tattooed on the inside of her eyelids.
D.S. Zara Salmond. Mum must have a thing about royalty, he'd thought. Had transferred from Vice and was there to make his life easier, she said, and began. Cases ebbed and flowed through his door. A teenage drug death, a run of high-end robberies, a nightclub stabbing. And he waded through them, but nothing could wrest his attention from the man who shared his office. Glenn Taylor, grinning like a monkey outside the Old Bailey, glimmered on the periphery of his day. "He's here somewhere," became his mantra as he quietly pored over every police report from the day Bella disappeared, wearing away the letters on his keyboard. Sparks heard on the station grapevine when they hauled Lee Chambers back in to have another look at him. He'd done his 3 months for the indecent exposure, lost his job, and had to move, but apparently he had lost none of his confidence. Chambers had wriggled in his chair, protesting his innocence, but told them more about his trade in porn, including his opening hours and regular haunts, in return for immunity from further prosecution. "One to watch," was the verdict from the new team, but they didn't believe he was their bloke. They spat him back out, but his information gave the service station search a new focus, and the CCTV finally yielded some of Chambers' customers. Sparks waited to hear if Glenn Taylor was among them.
"No sign, sir," Salmond told him. "But they're still looking."
And on they went. It was fascinating, like watching a dramatization of his investigation with actors playing the detectives.
"Like sitting in the orchestra," he told Eileen when she called.
"Who's playing you? Robert De Niro?"
"Oh no, I forgot. Helen Mirren," she laughed. But perching on the edge of his seat as a member of the audience, instead of being in the bubble of the investigation, gave him a view he'd never had before. He could survey the hunt, godlike. And that was when he began to notice the cracks and false starts.
"We focused on Taylor too quickly," he told D.S. Salmond. It had cost him a lot to admit it to himself, but it had to be done. "Let's look at the day Bella disappeared again, quietly."
Secretly, they started to rebuild October 2nd, 2006, from the moment the child woke, using the inside surfaces of a hastily emptied metal cabinet in the corner of Sparks's office to paste up their montage.
"Looks like an art project," Salmon joked. "Just need a bit of sticky back plastic and we'll get a gold star."
She wanted to do the timeline on the computer, but Sparks was worried it would be noticed.
"This way, we can get rid of it and leave no trace if we have to."
He hadn't been sure when Salmon asked to help him. She didn't tease him like Matthews did. He missed it, the intimacy and release of a shared joke. But it felt inappropriate with a woman. Flirtatious rather than comradely. Anyway, he didn't miss Ian Matthews's disgusting ketchup-slathered sausage sandwiches and the glimpses of his belly as his shirt came adrift. D.S. Salmond was very bright, but he didn't really know her or whether he could trust her. He'd have to. He needed her unemotional, clear-sightedness to stop him from veering off into the undergrowth again. Bella woke at 7:15, according to Dawn. A bit later than usual, but she was late to bed the night before.
"Why late to bed?" Salmon asked.
They scrolled through Dawn's statements.
"They went to McDonald's and had to wait for the bus home."
"Why?
Was it a treat?"
"Not her birthday. That's in April.
I thought Dawn was permanently short of money.
About 500 quid owed on her credit card,
and the neighbours said she rarely went out.
We didn't ask, according to this paperwork, Spark said.
It went on Salmon's list.
She's a girl who likes a list, Sparks thought. Woman.
Sorry. And then sweets at the newspaper shop. More treats. Wonder what was happening in their lives. Salmon wrote Smarties on a new piece of paper and pasted it up in the cabinet. They sat on opposite sides of his desk with Salmon in the boss's chair. Between them was a printout of the master file, acquired by Matthews as a parting gift. Sparks began to feel he was under interrogation, but his new sergeant was teasing out the missed questions, and he focused.
Did she have a new bloke in her life?
What about this Matt who got her pregnant? Did we ever talk to him? The holes in the investigation began to gape at Sparks accusingly. Let's do that now, Salmon said quickly, seeing the gloom descending on her boss. Bella's birth certificate had no father's name. As an unmarried mother, Dawn had no right to record a father unless he was present at the registration. But she told the police his name was Matt White, and he lived around the Birmingham area and worked for a pharmaceutical company.
He could get his hands on Viagra whenever he wanted, she told Sparks.
An initial search had failed to find a Matthew White in Birmingham who fit the bill. And then Taylor had entered the picture and everyone else was shoved into a drawer.
Matt might be a nickname. And I wonder if he gave her a false name, Salmon said.
Married men often do. Stops the new girlfriend getting in touch unexpectedly, especially after it's over.